Hello, this podcast is part of the Argekunz public program Soil Times for 2021, curated by BAU. The present series is titled Reading Rivers, an ongoing reading group that expands on the exhibitions and artistic practices shown at Argekunz. You will now listen to selected texts discussed during the reading group. The texts relate to the exhibition program and are read through the lens of soil and its relationship to human life.
Stones Like Us, Steine wie wir, ein Projekt von Katrin Hornig in Zusammenarbeit mit Sabina Holzer und der Körpersteinsammlung Tesadre. Text Sabina Holzer. Stones Like Us, Steine wie wir. Wenn wir die Landschaft als Körper begreifen, ist Sinn nicht eine ausschließliche Eigenschaft des Menschen. Hier drei Begriffe, die uns interessieren, deren Zwischenräume und Ränder wir suchen. Landschaft, Körper, Sinn. Landschaft, geschaffenes Land, Kulturland, kulturell geprägt, bearbeitetes, gepflegtes, geschaffenes Land. Land, das auch geworden ist, geschaffen in Millionen von Jahren, Schicht für Schicht, von Flüssigem zum Festen, verdichtet, verklumpt, zerrieben, zersetzt, erhitzt, geschmolzen, abgelagert, aufgeschwemmt, ausgeworfen, verwittert, kristallisiert, transformiert. Land, geformtes Land. Vielschichtige Ebenen, organisch, anorganisch organisiert, vielfältig gefaltet. So wie wir, hier. Wir, Ansammlung von Falten, Kerbungen, Ausstülpungen, Hohlräumen. Wir, Gefüge, Geröll, Textur, Landschaft, Körper. Mit dir. Erde und Stern in einem. Vielfältige Materie. Es gibt viele Arten, diese Situation zu betrachten, diese Zusammenkunft, dieses Ensemble. Diese Höhle, in der Steine gezeigt werden, die in menschlichen Körpern entstanden sind. Wie sind sie entstanden? Wie sind sie hierher gekommen? Die Ähnlichkeit dieser Steine mit ihrer Umgebung wird uns auffallen, hier, wenn wir uns umschauen und uns gegenseitig betrachten lassen. Und vielleicht werden wir die Kerbungen und Faltungen dieser Steine, die in menschlichen Körpern entstanden sind, mit dem Gedanken betrachten, dass wir uns gerade jetzt selbst in einer solchen Kerbung, einer Faltung befinden, zusammengefunden haben, auch wenn diese ein unzählbar Vielfaches größer ist. Wegen der Form, der Fragen des Formens sind die Steine hier. Wegen bewusstem und unbewusstem Formen. Die Frage, was Wissen bedeutet, worauf es deutet, welche Spuren es zieht. Und auch, woraus es sich zusammensetzt, gestaltet und eine Gestalt ausbildet. Lassen Sie uns, liebe Besucherin, lieber Besucher, in diesen Fragestellungen bei den Ähnlichkeiten bleiben. Lassen wir unsere Vorstellungskräfte spielen. Steinbildner. Vielleicht finden wir Ähnlichkeiten auf der gemeinsamen Ebene der Häute, der Oberflächen, der Einfaltungen, Nähte, Knospen, Säume, Keime von Bergen und Brunnen, Quellen, die nach oben steigen, Tropfen und Flüsse, Salze, Andersartiges, Wir senden, empfangen, erkennen und verwandeln. Hier diese Höhle, diese Falte, diese Kerbe und wir hier. Nicht im, nicht als Zentrum, ohne Zentrum. Ansammlung von Falten, Kerbungen, Ausstülpungen, Poren und Porositäten. Wir, Augenhöhlen, Achselhöhlen, Brusthöhlen, Bauchhöhlen, Beckenhöhlen. Hier in der Höhle. Geboren, um gewogen zu werden, gewichtig im Fall, in der Richtung, im Aufrichten, entlang der Vertikalen. Zwischen Himmel und Erde ein paar Gramm präzises Gewebe. Gefaltet in den frühesten Stadien unserer embryonalen Entwicklung. Einmal, hundertmal, Millionenmal. Evolutionäre Transformationswesen wir, Mischwesen quasi. Zusammengesetzt aus Elementen und Substanzen. Körper genannt Menschen, in deren Körpern sich Steine formen. Körpersteine, geformt aus unserer Lebensform, unseren Handlungen, diesen Aufzeichnungen, Texturen, Verfestigungen unserer Tätigkeiten und Untaten. Hinterlassene Ab- und Eindrücke von Ernährungsmustern. Aktivitäten und Passivitäten, greifbare Zeit, verzögerte Plötzlichkeit, Körpersedimente in Organgefäßen, geändert, gerillt, gedreht, geborgen in weichem Gewebe, mineralisierter Fluss, feste mineralische Masse, Mineralstoffe, anorganische Nährstoffe, die der menschliche Organismus nicht herstellen kann. Lebensnotwendige Stoffe, nicht organisch und doch Bestandteile des Organischen, vom lebenden Verbindungen. Leben instandhaltend, strukturgebend. Mineralien. Sie haben vor langer Zeit unser organisches Gewebe infiltriert. Darum gehen wir aufrecht. Darum sind unsere Knochen, wie sie sind, unsere Wirbeln, kleine Höhlendurchgänge von Fleisch umgeben. Mineralien. Sie formen die Grundarchitektur unserer Mobilität. Sie leiten die elektrischen Impulse unserer Nervensignale weiter und regulieren sie. Regulieren uns. Körpersteine. Mineralisierungen des Körpers, Zeugen bestimmter Mischverhältnisse von Säuren, Fetten, Cholesterin, Zeugen bestimmter Lebensumstände, bestimmter Ernährung, bestimmter Stresspegel, Menschenstress von Menschengeschichten, etwa von der des 16-jährigen ägyptischen Knaben, der vor 4800 Jahren lebte. Bei ihm wurde der erste Nierenstein gefunden. Oder von den Gastarbeitern der 1970er Jahre. Aus Angst, abgeschoben zu werden, produzierten sie immer mehr Steine. Geologische Verschiebungen sind das, diese Abschiebungen. Für den Einzelnen zerbersten da Welten. Wir wissen das, liebe Besucherin, lieber Besucher. Wir können uns das ganz leicht vorstellen. Heiliger Liberias, Schutzheiliger der Steine und ihrer Krankheiten, schütze uns vor der Angst. Schütze uns vor den Schmerzen. Schütze uns vor uns selbst und den kontinentalen Verschiebungen, den klimatischen Veränderungen, vor dem Grollen, dem Geröll, der Gallen, Nieren, Harren und Blasensteine. Hilf uns in unserem Werden. erden. Anders betrachtet. Wundersame Gebilde mit fremdklingenden Namen. Wewelit, Wedelit, Uruzit, Apatit, Struvit, Zystin. Auch Harnsteinsubstanzen genannt. Von unseren Körpern, von der Natur, innen und außen. Außen ist innen? Wir suchen Verbindungen. Wir sind halt aus denselben Stoffen gemacht. Wir sind halt durch selbe Milieu entstanden. Wir sind der bestehende Beweis dieser Naturkulturen, dieser mysteriösen Wechselwirkungen von Mineralien und geologischen Ablagerungen. Zwischen den Einzelteilen von Organismen, zwischen Organismen in Ökosystemen, zwischen organischem und anorganischem, lebendigen und nicht lebendigen Zwischenwesen wir. Mineralwesen wir, mit Apatit in den Knochen und auf den Zehen, mit Harnsäure, aus der Harnsteine entstehen, mit mineralogischen Namen, Namen nämlich von männlichen Forschern. Das war damals so, 1852. Zum Beispiel, ein Harnsteinmineral wurde im Glückaufschacht bei Burg in Sachsen entdeckt und voller Hochachtung nach dem Naturphilosophen Whewell benannt, nach William und seiner Vielfalt der Welten, seiner Philosophie der Entdeckung und noch vielem mehr. Überhaupt wird weltweit Wewelit in der Natur gefunden, hinterlässt oftmals seine Spuren. Zu Lande in Menschen, in Pflanzen, in Sauerampfer, Sternfrucht, Spinat, Mangold, rote Rüben, Kakao zum Beispiel. Auch im menschlichen Körper ist Wewelit am häufigsten. Er verbindet sich am liebsten mit Wedelit, dem seltenen, dem ausgefallenen Geschöpf, dem tetragonalen Kristallsystemstein, dem farblosen. Manchmal jedoch in zartem Gelb oder Braun gefärbt. Der Wedelit aus dem Wedelmeer. Wasserunlöslich liegt er im Meer, in unserer Niere, unserer Galle. Kaum in Kontakt mit Sauerstoff gibt er Wasser ab. Kristallines Wasser verwandelt sich in Wewelit. Weiß, dass eine Form der Zeit am Werk ist. Gibt sich ihr hin. Oder vielmehr einer Vielzahl von widersprüchlichen Zeiten, die Formen wandelt. Sie sind im selben Bild miteinander verbunden, in diesem Bild hier.
Entry 2, Porosity for Liverpool Biennale 2021. Text by curator and writer Sarah DeMuse. The human skin is a product of a journey as much as it is a facilitator of many journeys. The story goes that human bodies used to be more hairy, and when they started outrunning their predators, humans being better at long distances because their bodies could regulate body temperature through perspiration, they began to shed this fur. In other words, skin and skin color became gradually visible around the time humans turned into a so-called dominant species, developing not only their ability to run, but also their hunting, roasting, and dressing skills. The human skin is an organ that counts for about 15% of a human body's weight. It is a fine-tuned interface that protects by shielding the inner body from toxins, by preventing excess water loss, and by regulating the body temperature. It also communicates by receiving and decoding contextual information. It can register and react to temperature variations, it can sense texture, and most importantly, it can synthesize vitamin D from sunlight. It is, in other words, a medium.
Think of how it can absorb hormones, nicotine, nitroglycerin, and even opiate substitutes from engineered patches. Inversely, it can convey information to the environment through perspiration, rashing, or breaking out. There's the idea that the skin had to be a smooth, uniformly tinted, glowing, yet never oily, tightly stretched foil over the human flesh it covers. The skin functions as a top layer that seals that which is within, the wrapper that acts as a mirror of the inside. That mirror, however, is rippled, hairy, oily, at times wet and salty, and with occasional dry, even flaky patches. There's nothing permanent about skin. Its upper layer only exists for 3 to 4 weeks before turning to dust. There's also nothing pure about a skin. Besides accumulating or absorbing particles from the environment, the skin hosts about 1,000 species of bacteria. Basically, it's more similar to an ecosystem than to a single thing. At the dermatologist's office, a didactic poster depicts a cubic cross-section of skin, as if it were a caricature sample gone astray in a virtual education space. The poster indicates the anatomic components of the skin: the hair follicle, the sweat gland, the epidermis, the dermis, the hypodermis, the blood vessels, the lower connective tissue. The single hairs piece through the outer layer's uneven surface, which shows modest ripples like a calm summer lake. There are horizontal vectors, veins, as well as vertical ones, the hair, the perspiration gland, while the fat clusters behave a bit more messily. On a metaphorical level, it's the vertical vector in this cross-section that speaks to traffic, contact, infection, and exchange. To emphasize this in and out is to point to the human's necessary giving and taking from the environment. Without this verticality, there is no life, just a dividing cling wrap film. A pore is what we know as the smallest unit of skin. It's the part that acts up as a pimple or that freaks out as a goosebump. Our pores open up in warm, humid environments, and they shrink in cold climates. They are reactive. The word pore is related to port and porosity, all sharing an ancient Greek root, poros, which stands for passage, but also for journey. The skin is an amalgamate of chemical passages and cultural journeys, and that journey is distinct for every human. To ignore the differences in skins is to ignore histories and structures of dominance and brutal oppression. Most of these differences have been articulated through ideology, and ideology in turn is often turned into law. Both are created out of fear, a fear of losing power. The skin as divider is a screen of fear, a surface upon which to apply unspoken quantities of disinfectant, bleachers, self-tanners, toners, and whatnot, all to blend in and self-protect. This ideologized skin shuns touching other skin. Acknowledging the porosity of the human skin and daring to touch another's skin recognizes the passing, weathering, vanishing, varieting, and exchanging that come with the journey. The skin knows this, but it's time we started poring over that.
The Mushroom at the End of the World, Anna Singh. Geologists have begun to call our time the Anthropocene, the epoch in which human disturbance outranks other geological forces. As I write, the term is still new and still full of promising contradictions. Thus, although some interpreters see the name as implying the triumph of humans, the opposite seems more accurate. Without planning or intention, humans have made a mess of our planet. Furthermore, Despite the prefix anthropo, that is, human, the mess is not a result of our species' biology. The most convincing Anthropocene timeline begins not with our species, but rather with the advent of modern capitalism, which has directed long-distance destruction of landscapes and ecologies. This timeline, however, makes the anthropo even more of a problem. Imagining the human since the rise of capitalism entangles us with ideas of progress and with the spread of techniques of alienation that turn both humans and other beings into resources. Such techniques have segregated humans and policed identities, obscuring collaborative survival. The concept of the Anthropocene both evokes this bundle of aspirations, which one might call the modern human conceit, and raises the hope that we might muddle beyond it. Can we live inside this regime of the human and still exceed it? Progress is a forward march, drawing other kinds of time into its rhythms. Without that driving beat, we might notice other temporal patterns. Each living thing remakes the world through seasonal pulses of growth, lifetime reproductive patterns, and geographies of expansion. Within a given species, too, there are multiple time-making projects as organisms enlist each other and coordinate in making landscapes. The regrowth of the cutover cascades and Hiroshima's radio ecology show us each multi-species time-making. The curiosity I advocate follows such multiple temporalities, revitalizing description and imagination. This is not a simple empiricism in which the world invents its own categories. Instead, agnostic about where we are going, we might look for what has been ignored because it never fit the timeline of progress. Consider again the snippets of Oregon history with which I began this chapter. The first, about railroads, tells of progress. It led to the future. Railroads reshaped our destiny. The second is already an interruption, a history in which the destruction of forests matters. What it shares with the first, however, is the assumption that the trope of progress is sufficient to know the world, both in success and failure. The story of decline offers no leftovers, no excess, nothing that escapes progress. Progress still controls us, even in tales of ruination. Yet the modern human conceit is not the only plan for making worlds. We are surrounded by many world-making projects, human and not human. World-making projects emerge from practical activities of making lives. In the process, these projects alter our planet. To see them in the shadow of the Anthropocene's anthropo, we must reorient our attention. Many pre-industrial livelihoods, from foraging to stealing, persist today, and new ones, including commercial mushroom picking, emerge. But we neglect them because they are not a part of progress. These livelihoods make worlds too, and they show us how to look around rather than ahead. Making worlds is not limited to humans. We know that beavers reshape streams as they make dams, canals, and lodges. In fact, all organisms make ecological living places, altering earth, air, and water. Without the ability to make workable living arrangements, species would die out. In the process, each organism changes everyone's world. Bacteria made our oxygen atmosphere, and plants help maintain it. Plants live on land because fungi made soil by digesting rocks. As these examples suggest, world-making projects can overlap, allowing room for more than one species. Humans, too, have always been involved in multi-species world-making. Fire was a tool for early humans, not just to cook, but also to burn the landscape, encouraging edible bulbs and grasses that attracted animals for hunting. Humans shape multi-species worlds when our living arrangements make room for other species. This is not just a matter of crops, livestock, and pets. Pines, with their associated fungal partners, often flourish in landscapes burned by humans. Pines and fungi work together to take advantage of bright open spaces and exposed mineral soils. Humans, pines, and fungi make living arrangements simultaneously for themselves and for others, multi-species worlds. 20th century scholarship, Advancing the Modern Human Conceit, conspired against our ability to notice the divergent, layered, and conjoined projects that make up worlds. Entranced by the expansion of certain ways of life over others, scholars ignored questions of what else was going on. As progress tales lose traction, however, it becomes possible to look differently. The concept of assemblage is helpful. Ecologists turn to assemblages to get around the sometimes fixed and bounded connotations of ecological community. The question of how the varied species in a species assemblage influence each other, if at all, is never settled. Some thwart or eat each other. Others work together to make life possible. Still others just happen to find themselves in the same place. Assemblages are open-ended gatherings. They allow us to ask about communal effects without assuming them. They show us potential histories in the making. For my purposes, however, I need something other than organisms as the elements that gather. I need to see life ways and non-living ways of being as well, coming together. Non-human ways of being, like human ones, shift historically. For living things, species identities are a place to begin. But they are not enough. Ways of being are emergent effects of encounters. Thinking about humans makes this clear. Foraging for mushrooms is a way of life, but not a common characteristic of all humans. The issue is the same for other species. Pines find mushrooms to help them use human-made open spaces. Assemblages don't just gather life ways, they make them. Thinking through assemblage urges us to ask, how do gatherings sometimes become happenings, that is, greater than the sum of their parts? If history without progress is indeterminate and multidirectional, might assemblages show us its possibilities? Patterns of unintentional coordination develop in assemblages. To notice such patterns means watching the interplay of temporal rhythms and scales in the divergent life phase that gather. Surprisingly, this turns out to be a method that might revitalize political economy as well as environmental studies. Assemblages drag political economy inside them, and not just for humans. Plantation crops have lives different from those of their free-living siblings. Cart horses and hunter steeds share species but not life phase. Assemblages cannot hide from capital and the state. They are sites for watching how political economy works. If capitalism has no teleology, we need to see what comes together, not just by prefabrication, but also by juxtaposition. Other authors use assemblage with other meanings. The qualifier polyphonic may help explain my variant. Polyphony is music in which autonomous melodies intertwine. In Western music, the madrigal and the fugue are examples of polyphony. These forms seem archaic and strange to many modern listeners because they were superseded by music in which a unified rhythm and melody holds the composition together. In the classical music that displaced Baroque, unity was the goal. This was progress in just the meaning I have been discussing, a unified coordination of time. In 20th century rock and roll, this unity takes the form of a strong beat, suggestive of the listener's heart. We are used to hearing music with a single perspective. When I first learned polyphony, it was a revelation in listening. I was forced to pick out separate, simultaneous melodies and to listen for the moments of harmony and dissonance they created together. This kind of noticing is just what is needed to appreciate the multiple temporal rhythms and trajectories of the assemblage. For those not musically inclined, it may be useful to imagine the polyphonic assemblage in relation to agriculture. Since the time of the plantation, commercial agriculture has aimed to segregate a single crop and work towards its simultaneous ripening for a coordinated harvest. But other kinds of farming have multiple rhythms. In the shifting cultivation I studied in Indonesian Borneo, many crops grew together in the same field, and they had quite different schedules. Rice, bananas, taro, sweet potatoes, sugarcane, palms, and fruit trees mingled. Farmers needed to attend to the varied schedules of maturation of each of these crops. These rhythms were their relation to human harvests, if we add other relations, for example, to pollinators or other plants. Rhythms multiply. The polyphonic assemblage is the gathering of these rhythms as they result from world-making projects, human and not human. The polyphonic assemblage also moves us into the unexplored territory of the modern political economy. Factory labor is an exemplar of coordinated progress time. Yet, the supply chain is infused with polyphonic rhythms. Consider the tiny Chinese garment factory studied by Nelly Xu. Like its many competitors, it served multiple supply lines, constantly switching among orders for local boutique brands, knockoff international brands, and generic to-be-branded-later production. Each required different standards, materials, and kinds of labor. The factory's job was to match industrial coordination to the complex rhythms of supply chains. Rhythms further multiply when we move out of factories to watch foraging for an unpredictable wild product. The farther we stray into the peripheries of capitalist production, the more coordination between polyphonic assemblages and industrial processes becomes central to making a profit. As the last example suggests, abandoning progress rhythms to watch polyphonic assemblages is not a matter of virtuous desire. Progress felt great. There was always something better ahead. Progress gave us the progressive political causes with which I grew up. I hardly know how to think about justice without progress. The problem is that progress stopped making sense. More and more of us looked up one day and realized that the emperor had no clothes. It is in this dilemma that new tools for noticing seem so important. Indeed, life on earth seems at stake.